Hey, this is Paul Dini.
This is Misty Lee.
And this is Mark Evanier.
Yes, a regular guest, and I think we're just going to add your name to the title.
He's never left, and we've actually enrolled him in school in the neighborhood.
Yes.
We've been sending him off with a packed lunch every day.
And a beanie.
We don't really know where he goes. We think it's to school, but
everybody knows we tape these all at once. You're not fooling anyone.
you're destroying the illusion. Told a magician's secret.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Mask, man. And they don't really saw the leg in half either.
Oh, jeez.
And Rosebud was his sled.
Oh, no. And Bruce Willis was dead the whole time.
Yeah. That's right.
Right, yes.
And Charlton Heston was on Earth all along.
Oh, no.
Spoiler alert.
Do you want to talk about Earl at all?
If we could, I'll talk about Earl, sure. Kress, we just lost him a couple weeks ago.
Yep.
One of my closest friends, a lovely man, had no enemies, completely undespised. He was an animation writer, a comic book writer, an actor, mm-hmm. a historian. He was responsible for a lot of the great salvage jobs done on animation for DVDs and CDs where they found old prints of things. Like for instance, Hanna-Barbera had lost the original main titles to the Flintstones.
Oh.
The first season of the Flintstones had a different opening with a different theme song than the one we all know and love. And when they were going to put together the home video of them, those episodes, Earl said, no, you can't put the second season opening on the first season shows. They said, well, we can't find the first season. Earl went into the vaults there and searched, and he finally found it mislabeled.
And, really?
And that is on DVDs now because of Earl. He did lots of stuff like that. He found old tapes and old audio. He produced a couple of CDs of Hanna-Barbera music. Mm-hmm. The main thing he was a very good writer, very clever writer. He had a couple of Emmys for Tiny Toons and, I think, Animaniacs.
Picking
the Brain. Mm-hmm. And... a nice, wonderful guy who just got real sick a couple times in his life. And he had a heart transplant at one point, and he survived that. And
now, where did his heart come from?
He had a teenage girl's heart. I spent weeks convincing him that any day now he'd start menstruating. And I got him half to the point where he was like, you know where they sell Kotex? I mean, anyway, I almost got him convinced of that. I thought that would be a good thing to do. But we had a lovely little service for him. You were present for it.
Spoke there.
I spoke, and I told about how we met. Dawes Butler introduced us. If you remember, I announced at the funeral that anybody who didn't know at the funeral who didn't know what who Dawes Butler was should get the hell out of Earl Kress's funeral.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
And the priest almost left at that point. Dawes had this class in his work. Dawes taught the last 10 or 15 years of his life. Dawes had a workshop in his garage. He had a little studio in his garage. He had his lovely home in Beverly Hills. And one night a week, he would take private students on other days, individual. But Thursday nights, he would have a class. And he would bring in people who were promising. And a lot of really, really good people came out of that class. Nancy Cartwright came out of that class.
Who is the voice of Bart
Simpson? Out of that class.
What was the other one you said?
Greg Berger? Greg Burson, Corey Burton.
Wow.
Everybody who got a voice job for the first time in the late 80s came out of that class.
Wow.
And one of the reasons so many good people came out of that class was because Dawes is a great teacher. But another reason was that you had to have talent to get in.
Okay.
He would not take anyone who could write a check. You had to audition for him, and if he didn't think you had talent, he would tell you politely, lovingly, but firmly. And he would not take you. And he took Earl, and the class was a class in how to be a voice actor, but it was also a class in comedy, how to be funny and how to read copy and stuff. And it was also indirectly a class in how to be a great person, because Dawes was a great person. Mm-hmm. And being around him, Jack Kirby was the same way. When you were around Jack Kirby, you felt more creative.
Really?
And yeah, there was something about him. First of all, because here was this enormous, great talent, and it's true of both Dawes and Jack. I was very blessed to know both of them. Mm-hmm. He was this very great talent who was beyond competition. Jack and Dawes were not in competition with anybody. Mm-hmm. They knew they were great at what they did in a non-conceited way. Mm-hmm. It was like an established fact. You know, it's like, you know, there's no point in false modesty. You know, I once saw Sandy Koufax saying, "Well, I'm not that great a pitcher." Yes, Sandy, you were that great a pitcher. Mm-hmm. You know, the stats prove it. Well, Dawes and Jack had their greatness in the same sense, where nobody around them questioned that they were the best at what they did, and they didn't wear it. They didn't lord it over you. They talked to you like equals. Mm-hmm. They talked to you like you were just as good as they were. And if somebody who is brilliant treats you like you're an equal, you're going to start feeling like an equal, whether you are or not. Obviously, the people Dawes talked to were not as good as Dawes as the people Jack talked to were not as good as Jack. But you just felt so energized by them. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they treated you with that dignity, you thought, well, I can live up to this. I can. It's just like, you know, the greatest way for an actor to learn to act is to act opposite good actors.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're on a stage with, you know, Laurence Olivier, and you're holding your own, you become a better actor. You have to for your right to stay there. But when you were talking to Jack, you had to come up to his level a little bit. You had to become at least feel more creative. And Dawes was like that, and he taught people, and it's a wonderful class. And Earl was in that class. And at one point, Dawes said to Earl, "You know, there's this guy named Mark Evanier you should meet." And I'd sat in. I didn't take the classes. I wasn't a voice actor, but I sat in a few of them, and I think I met Earl briefly at one of those classes, but we didn't connect there. And Dawes phoned me. And, you know, Dawes was one of these guys who, if he called you and said, "Would you tap dance naked on the freeway during rush hour?" you would have gone out and done it.
Of course.
Because, first of all, it was Huckleberry Hound telling you to do it, right?
Yeah.
But he said, "I want you to meet this friend, Earl Kress." And Earl and I met, and we just hit it off. We liked all the same things. We were both nuts about Laurel and Hardy. We were both nuts about It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Mm-hmm. We were both nuts about cartoon voices. We were both nuts about Dawes. We were both nuts about Jay Ward cartoons. We had very much the same taste and everything. And became just great friends. And, you know, I had to go through this, you know, not to the extent his family did, obviously, but he had this cancer the last 6 or 8 months of his life, and it was very sad because he knew he was failing, and he was angry about it. You know, there's a certain anger that you can have in being sick, and he was angry about it, and it was tough to talk to him.
Right.
And it was heartbreaking, but it was his life was moving in one direction. It was not up.
Yeah.
And the last time I saw him, I don't know. This is getting very maudlin, isn't it?
No, it's fine. Oh, well, it's interesting. It's hard.
They had this. It was very strange. They had this 94th birthday party for June Foray, and I went to the party and put in an appearance, and we toasted June and had a nice thing. And then I went over to Earl's. For what I realized when I was there, it was the last time I'd see him.
Oh.
It was a Thursday night. And he died very early the following Monday morning, and he was not able to communicate. We're sat there talking, trying to talk, and there was nothing we could talk about. This is the first time I'd ever been with Earl. We had nothing to talk about. We couldn't shut us up. We would talk about cartoons we'd seen or movies we'd seen or Laurel Hardy things, or you could talk about anything. We were two guys who could talk for 3 hours about one scene, and it's a mad, 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 mad world.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
he never took you to see the Giant Egg.
He never took me to see the speaker who preceded me at the funeral talked about how Earl had taken him to see the Big W down at Earl had found where it was and had taken him to see it down in Palos Verdes. So I got up following the guy and I said, "Earl was my friend for 27 years," and I took a pause and said, "Never took me to see the Big W." But, you know, I have this odd theory. I have a lot of friends who are sick, and I have this odd theory that indirectly blames it all on George W. Bush. The Great Depression in this country was not just a depression financial. It was a depression of people. People were depressed.
That's true.
People are depressed now, and being depressed makes people sick.
Yeah.
And I think that Earl was depressed before he got sick, because he was having some career problems. Mm-hmm. He was just having trouble you know, as a lot of people, a lot of very good people do.
Mm-hmm.
And he was taken from us before he had a chance. I'm sure he would have bounced back from it, but he was taken from us before he had a chance to bounce back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of other friends who are ill, and I think some of it is directly related to the fact. I mean, first of all, you know, getting sick is always directed to the fact that you lose your health insurance,
yes,
as people have. Mm-hmm. And Earl did not lose his health insurance.
Well, that's good.
But he had to fight for it. But also, if you spend all night worrying about money, and you're terrified of this, you're not going to sleep well. You're not going to eat right. You're not going to go to the doctor maybe when you should.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend named Gary Sherman, who was the brother of Steve Sherman, who was my partner on the Jack Kirby stuff I mentioned earlier. Gary died at about age 52 or something like that. No, younger than that. He died at a way too early an age,
yeah,
52 or 51.
That's way too young.
Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons was when he got sick, he was afraid to go to the doctor because he just couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. He wasn't working at that time, and he didn't go to the doctor. And finally, when he did go to the doctor said, "Where were you 8 months ago? We could have treated this a lot better 8 months ago."
Mm-hmm.
This is the depressing part of the podcast, isn't it?
I think it's hilarious.
Yes.
It's a life lesson.
So it anyway.
It's mm-hmm. important.
Yeah.
And that was why I asked you to talk about
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, Earl was a great guy, and we lose great guys. Yeah. You go through this. I feel very weird sometimes on my blog. I post a lot of obits.
Mm-hmm.
And I started doing it because nobody else was doing it. Great figures of the comic book business would pass away. And I was the only person who covered it on the internet until about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, when a few websites developed some more journalism skill. I was the only, if I didn't write about these guys, nobody else would. And I still was the only guy who wrote about Del Cannell when he passed away recently, a major figure in the comic book business.
Sure.
You still have people who just, nobody, and if they did write about them all, they just said, "Mark Cavanier reports."
They do.
And they linked to my blog.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be the only, I didn't want to be responsible for that. Mm. But I was posting all these obits, and I just kept feeling like, I'm becoming the mantle of death on this, on the internet for people in the cartoon business or the comic book business. But I'm going to be 60 next year, and you have to start facing the fact that friends are getting older, mm-hmm. and as their friends get older, they go faster, and it makes you want to cling more to the people who are around and not say, "Oh, one of these days I've got to tell this person how much they mean to me."
Yeah.
You don't just say it anymore. You have to say it while the people are still around.
Yeah.
So, well, I think a hell of a lot of you, Mark.
Well, you're wonderful too, Misty. You are so, Misty. You just, I was at the castle last night, or the last time I was at the castle, I walked in and I said to the lady at the desk, I said, "Is Misty Lee working here tonight?" And they said, "No, she isn't. But we always love to see her."
Oh, that's nice.
They said that, yes. So, yeah. And that's. I'll tell you a story. When I was 9 or 10, my mother took me to New York. She wanted to take me back to Hartford. My family's from Hartford.
Okay.
And she wanted to take me back and show me to my grandmother and vice versa.
Oh.
I have interest in my grandmother, which went to going to Hartford, Connecticut, and some other relatives. So we made a three-city trip. We made a two-week trip. Went to New York to see New York. We went to Hartford and went to Boston. Went to Boston to see all the old Paul Revere's house and
of
stuff
course.
Like that.
Walk the Red Line.
So we're walking around New York one day, and we were going to go to Radio City Music Hall to see Audrey Hepburn in The Nun's Story.
Oh, my.
Which I didn't really want to see that movie, but my mother wanted to see Radio City Music Hall, and that was what we were playing.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So we walked through Rockefeller Center, and a man with a clipboard comes up to us and says, "Excuse me, madam, would you like to see a TV show being done?" Not taped, live. This is when they were doing live. Game shows in the afternoon were live then.
Wow.
And she said, "Would you like to see it?" We're at NBC, and they were short for audience. So they sent this guy out to drum up a crowd to see the shows. And my mother said, "Oh, could we see Treasure Hunt," which was a game show we liked at the time, hosted by Jan Murray. And he said, "Well, I'm not sure if we can do Treasure Hunt or not, but and my mother said, "Isn't my son too young to see these things?" And And the guy said, "Well, he looks like he's well behaved. Okay, you know, they were so desperate for audience, they were going to let kids in, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we went upstairs.
They look clean.
And they sent us on a brief tour. This little 15-minute tour of NBC.
Cool.
Which I only remember that the person conducting the tour knew less about television than I did.
Oh.
And I was correcting them. And then they said,
"I can see baby Mark correcting."
Yes. And then they said, "We can't get you into Treasure Hunt. We can let you go see Concentration." So he said, "Okay, fine." And there were big prizes if you went to see Concentration. The audience gets prizes. So they lined us up to go see Concentration. And across the hall, this was, I think it was sixth floor, the same studio that Letterman and Conan O'Brien used. We were going to go into. And it was either 6A or 6B. And Treasure Hunt was across the hall. If we were in 6A, they were in 6B or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And there was a line of people to go see Treasure Hunt. They were going to go in. We had a half an hour to wait, or maybe the way around. So while we're standing there, waiting to go into Concentration, Jan Murray comes by, the host of Concentration, wearing a sport coat that Spike Jonze would have rejected as being in bad taste. And he just works the line. He's what he's doing at this point. I think this line was the overflow line. Mm-hmm. And he's apologizing that people aren't going to get in. And he came out and he shook hands and signed a few autographs and just schmoozed the line, joked with people. And then he came over and said hello to our line. And it was the first time I'd ever met someone I knew on television. Now, my next door neighbor when I was growing up was on the Andy Griffith Show, Betty Lynn, who played Thelma Lou.
Oh, wow.
But she was Betty. She wasn't a celebrity. She was Aunt Betty next door.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like family. And she wasn't like an entertainer who stood out on stage in one and did stuff like Jan Murray did. And I remember thinking at that time, I thought to myself, you know, I don't want to be what Jan Murray does. I can't do what Jan Murray does. I could never do that. I could never get in front of an audience and tell jokes and perform like that. But I'd like people to be as happy to see me as those people are to see Jan Murray walk down the hall. Everybody just was so happy just that he was there. And he came out and was nice to them and stuff like that. And I thought that was kind of a life-changing moment for me. And then, of course, then we went to see Concentration. And they sat me in the bleachers where I couldn't see a thing. So I watched the whole thing on the monitor. And on the way out, the valuable prize they gave us was a tube of Vaseline that I saw in the drugstores at that time for 19 cents. So anyway.
Did you ever see the Tyra Banks Vaseline thing when she... It makes me think of that. I will send it to you. There is a YouTube clip of Tyra Banks making fun of the Oprah show, where they give away the vehicles, and Tyra Banks gave everybody Vaseline, and she had them bejeweled,
and
they really made a big deal out of it, and so it's very apropos.
You get a Vaseline, and you get a Vaseline.
That's exactly what she did. You get Vaseline, and you get Vaseline.
So now, part two of this story now.
Yes.
Years later, 1963 or something like that, we take my Aunt Dot to the airport.
I love that you had an Aunt Dot, by the way.
To go to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And in the airport, we run into Maury Amsterdam. We were like driving around the airport looking for a parking space. This is back when you used to not just drop people off the curb, you'd actually take them into the airport
gate
and wait at the gate with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my Aunt Dot was going to Las Vegas that night, and we're driving around the parking lot, and a woman who was carrying a suitcase, her suitcase opened up and all of her underwear fell out.
Oh, no.
And I jumped, and it was blocking traffic as she was picking up, and I jumped out of the car and helped her pick up her underwear.
Yes.
I think I actually said to her, "Here, you dropped your panties." Anyway, so, and while we were waiting, the car behind us couldn't park either.
Uh-huh.
And that had Maury Amsterdam in it.
Oh.
And when he finally found a parking space, he got out of his car and he sprinted with a little overnight bag and one of these suit things you carry over your shoulder to keep your suit.
Like a garment bag?
Yeah, garment bag, right. And so he gets in and he was waiting for the same flight, which was delayed.
Oh.
Because he was going to Vegas that night to fill in for Corbett Monica, who was sick at some hotel. He was the opening act for somebody, I think it was maybe a Sinatra, and he was sick, so Maury was flying to Vegas to fill in for him that night. So my Aunt Dot says to him, "Oh, Mr. Amsterdam, you were so patient out in the parking lot, and we love the Dick Van Dyke Show. It's our favorite show." And I heard her say this, and I thought, "Hey, Dick Van Dyke's my favorite show. Dick Van Dyke Show is my favorite show too." And I went up to Maury Amsterdam, and I was 12 or 11, whatever it was at the time. And I said, oh, the Dick Van Dyke Show is my favorite show. And Maury Amter says, hey, you want to come see us film an episode? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, be my personal guests. And he pulls out a business card. It was not his. It was somebody else's. Okay. He writes a phone number in the back. And he says, here, you call this number tomorrow, and you tell him that you're Maury Amter's personal guest, and you come to a filming, and I'll give you a personal tour, and I'll introduce you to the whole cast. So I kind of went, hamana, chef of the future.
Yeah.
So the next day we called up, and we picked a date to go see the Dick Van Dyke Show being filmed. And we went to the studio. We got there early. We had these VIP seats. They took us in right away. They sat us in the bleachers for the Danny Thomas show, which was next door.
Okay.
Just so it place us someplace, because they weren't ready to open the house on the Van Dyke show.
Oh, okay.
Danny Thomas was not filming that day. They just used their bleachers to house us. They brought us in. We're in the Dick Van Dyke Show, and we saw the Dick Van Dyke Show film an episode. And as luck would have it, it was an episode that did not have Maury Amsterdam in it, Rosemarie or Richard Deacon or Larry Matthews. It just had Dick Van Dyke, Mary Tyler Moore, Jerry Paris, and Ann Morgan Gilbert.
Still a hell of a cast.
Yeah, and we were sitting in the front row of the bleachers, and Carl Reiner was the host. Usually, Rosemarie and Maury Amsterdam were the host. They did the warm-up and hosted the audience.
Oh.
But since they weren't even there that day, Carl Reiner did it. And he was brilliant. And he was funny. And he was so funny, the show couldn't follow the warm-up. He was so funny. Mm. And I met Dick Van Dyke, and I saw Mary Tyler Moore come out. And it was the first time I'd ever seen Mary Tyler Moore, A, in person, B, in color.
Mm-hmm.
And see, I was 3 feet from her, and I thought she was the best looking person, place, or thing on the planet. Hmm. And that was the moment I decided I wanted to be a TV writer. I didn't want to be a performer, I thought, but I want to be around people like that. I wasn't even thinking like I want to sleep with people like that. I want to be around people like that, because Dick Van Dyke was so cool. He was doing magic tricks during the break for people to keep, and we started talking about about Laurel and Hardy when I was there. And at one point, the guy who was slating the episode, he gives the code number. He says, DVD, 7 episode, whatever the number was. You know. And then they had to stop. It was a false start. And Carl Reiner, filling in, said, we're the only TV show with the initials DVD. And I yelled out, what about Death Valley Days? And it got this huge laugh from the audience, and Carl ran, oh my God, you're right. You know, and I felt very proud of myself. And that was the moment I decided, I knew I wanted to be a writer before that, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to be a writer of, and I thought, I want to write TV shows.
Yes.
And there were two guys in sweaters holding script binders who I figured out were Sam Denhoff and Bill Persky, the writers, the story editors, writers of the show. And they were down there, and I said, that, I looked at Bill Persky and said, I said, I want to be one of those guys. Flash forward years later, I'm writing Welcome Back, Cotter. I'm on the set of, Welcome Back, Cotter. And I'm on the set, and I'm standing there with my little script binder, and I walked there, and I look up at the bleachers, and I suddenly went, the audience bleachers during a taping, I suddenly went, uh-oh. I made it. I'm one of those people that I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And those are my two big life-changing experiences at TV show filmings, TV show broadcasts. Mm. And the third one was I went to see the Red Skelton show twice. Once I went to see an evening taping of the show, and the special guest was Marcel Marceau. Oh. They did an entire hour in pantomime.
Did you write his... Oh, I was going to tease you and say, did you write his lines?
And a couple weeks later, a friend of mine got me into one of Red Skelton's rehearsals, where I learned every dirty joke in the world. Red Skelton would do these strange rehearsals where he just ignored the script and just told dirty jokes for an hour.
Awesome.
Filthy, dirty jokes. He had Phyllis Diller was his guest, and they didn't do one line that was on the cue cards.
Awesome.
And Red just, and you know, so wow. Those were my big experiences going to see. I had a few others also, but those were the three.
We'll save those for the next time you're on.
Yes.
I became aware of the story. You probably know the story too, but it was a... it was posted on an animation site recently, a letter from Chuck Jones to his daughter about what he was doing. And this was in like the mid to late 50s when he was directing at Warner Brothers. And this really speaks to what you were saying about Dawes bringing out the best in people. Chuck was directing a Bugs Bunny short called Barbary Coast Bunny. And I think it was maybe the first time he had used Dawes, or I don't think he was familiar with him before that. But in the letter he wrote to his daughter, he was saying, I just did this short Barbary Coast Bunny. I used this new guy, Dawes Butler, and he was really terrific. The gist of the letter was he was really terrific, and he made Mel step up his game a little bit. Because he came in, and he had this character called Nasty Canasta that he had used before. But I guess for this short, he kind of reworked him a little bit. In the earlier cartoons, Canasta's a big, brawny, like a Bluto-type guy. In this one, he's more of a slob. And and what Dawes did was he did this voice, which was kind of like a heavier version of Mr. Jinx. It was like a Brando-esque voice. It wasn't an imitation of Brando, but it was like, he took his time with the voice, like that. So it's like, come here, my little friend. You want to play a gambling game or something like that? And I'm doing the voice wrong, but
yeah, no, I think I remember that. That's the Gold Rush sort of thing,
yeah,
episode, and he's a big
yeah. What you got, sucker? He was just giving it this kind of. Canasta is sort of a slob character, so he's doing a
I got five aces here, which you can't beat.
And then in the letter, Jones was. Mel Blanc is terrific, but he said. Jones was saying it shook Mel Blanc up a little bit that Dawes was playing around the character, so he was doing some things like at one point Bugs comes in as his hayseed and Mel started doing this little
remember that.
And we're gonna play this game and you could win. He goes, really? Like that. Yeah. And so Mel started playing back, because Mel, I guess
that's
at that point was so used to it that, and Chuck was really, inspired by what Dawes had done, that he really
Mel was never intimidated by anybody. Here's a guy who played opposite Jack Benny,
but he
was aware that Dawes was his only he told me once he considered Dawes his only real competition. He respected a lot of people, but Dawes was the only guy he felt was really on the same tier or close to it. And Dawes had a certain grudging respect for Mel. He didn't like some of the things about the way Mel treated people or didn't let other people have credit on things.
But
he respected the talent enormously because Dawes really understood good acting. And Mel was very good. People forget how good he was. When they talk about this guy being the man of 1,000 voices, that's missing the whole point. First of all, he didn't have 1,000 voices. He had about 35.
Yeah.
But what he was just a good comedian.
Yeah.
He was a good actor, and he could make these characters very round and fleshed out. And Dawes had that ability, too. One of the secrets of the Hanna-Barbera success was that Dawes' voice made up for the fact that the animation didn't have a lot of personality in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Tom Kenny recently, and Tom was a student of Dawes's.
Yeah.
And I said to him, there were times when they would bring the characters back, in the 70s and, Yogi's Ark and some other things, and I said,
Spruce Goose.
Yeah, and the character sounds okay. I mean, Dawes sounds okay, but he's not having. Did he kind of lose the flair for the characters? And Tom said no. He talked to Dawes about it, and Dawes said they're not letting me act. They have me come in. I say the line, and then I have to leave. But a character like Mr. Jinx, for instance, he's all play. I mean, he takes his time with the lines. Same with Hokey Wolf and Yogi. It's like listening to a comedian. A comedian just doesn't deliver the joke. He rolls it around a little bit. He has some fun with it. And so I think Tom said that the latter part of his career, Dawes regretted the fact that it was just so, almost like mechanical.
Yeah, well, Dawes had some medical problems his last few years. He had a stroke, and the first thing he did when he came back from his stroke was he did this primetime Yogi Bear special I wrote, and he had a lot of problems reading because the stroke had limited his peripheral vision, and he couldn't read ahead. We typed the scripts in narrow columns for him, but he was used to reading the whole sentence at once and knowing what was coming before he got to it, and it threw him off that he had to keep looking ahead and stopping, and he took a lot of takes for things, and we recorded him separately from the other actors. Mel was on that episode also, and they weren't in the studio at the same time because Dawes didn't want to embarrass himself in front of Mel.
Was that the Christmas one?
That was the Christmas.
That's
All-Star,
a very good one.
Christmas
yeah,
special.
That's a really good one.
And Dawes was playing Huckleberry Hound and Quick Draw and Yogi and Mr. Jinx was in it and Snagglepuss. And that's the one where Snagglepuss got bleeped.
Oh, Oh, for St. Hanukkah.
For St. Hanukkah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote a cartoon, a Christmas cartoon, where they bleeped the word Hanukkah.
Why?
I had Snagglepuss saying, "Season's greetings, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah even," and they bleeped Hanukkah.
I guess they thought it was disrespectful.
Someone thought that, you know...
Where now they can't even say Christmas, it's all happy holidays.
They would have to say Hanukkah, you know.
But Hanukkah was actually bleeped, and it's bleeped on the DVD.
Oh, wow. Really?
It was bleeped on the original network broadcast, but it was bleeped on the DVD. It's on the negative. They bleeped it on the negative.
Oh, my goodness. So you won't be able to replace that with the original at all?
No, it's gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's this, you know, I thought we were supposed to run television.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought my people ran the television industry. Why are they bleeping Hanukkah? You know, so we're telling how this Yogi Bear special I wrote, Dawes Butler was coming back from Misty just walked back into the room.
I did. I was hiding, you guys.
Dawes had a stroke, so he had trouble reading, mm-hmm. but he came across very well. And the night that it aired, Dawes called me right after it aired in L.A., and he was very happy with how he sounded on the finished show. It was the first time he'd seen the show on mm-hmm. the air, and he was real happy. And while we were talking, he got a call waiting beep, and he went away. He was away for about 6 minutes. Mm-hmm. He came back. Oh, I'm sorry, I kept you waiting. It was Don Messick.
Oh.
Who had called him from Santa Barbara. Dawes had been recorded separately. He hadn't known any of the other actors. And Messick was saying, Dawes, you sounded just like your old self.
Aww.
And while he's talking... There was another call waiting beep, and he goes away. He comes back 4 minutes later. He says, "That was Paul Frees calling to say."
Wow.
And then he got another one, and then he got off the phone. He called me back about half an hour later. And he said he'd heard from Hans Conried, he'd heard from June Foray, he'd heard from Alan. Everybody had called him to say, "Welcome back, Dawes. You sounded like your old self."
That's great.
He was very happy
because he was allowed to act.
Well, it was because he managed to triumph over his stroke, I think was the main operative thing.
That's amazing.
But he was such a lovely man.
Uh-huh.
And the last time, his last job would have been on a Garfield. I booked him to do a Garfield, doing kind of a Phil Silvers, I wanted his Hokey Wolf voice.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I wrote an episode for him, and I booked him, and he called me up and he said, "I don't really... I'll come in, but I was wondering if you could postpone. I'm not feeling that great." And I got the feeling he was saying to me, "I don't want to screw up for you. I'd rather I don't think I can live up to my standard." So I let him out of the booking. I said, I told him we'd postpone the episode, and I didn't. I recorded that episode with Larry Storch, ended up playing the character.
Interesting.
Larry Storch. And then Dawes passed away about 4 weeks later. This Garfield would have been his last job, probably. I don't think he did anything else after that. Oh. And, you know, we were very sad because he was such a wonderful figure. He was such a wonderful, lovely man. And he just oozed everything that was good about writing and creativity. It just radiated it. And anyway, so...
I was watching some of the old Quick Draw shorts recently, and it's funny that Snagglepuss started out as a villain in Quick Draw McGraw, and the voice is still identifiable, but he's still doing the Bert Lahr parody, but it's more like the bully cowardly lion, like, "Little tough guy, come on, yeah. You know, like that.
Yeah, he never really did Bert Lahr. He did a voice that reminded you of Bert Lahr, just as his Hokey Wolf was not Phil Silvers.
Right.
It was what you think Phil Silvers sounded like.
Yeah.
And usually what he did was he put two people together.
Yeah.
He'd take different voices and he'd put them together. And he just, he was the voice that I remember. When I was a kid, you know, he was in a lot of the Jay Ward cartoons. He was in a lot of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
Captain Crunch.
He was on the Stan Freberg records that I loved.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time I thought everything good I love has either Dawes Butler and or June Foray in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Wow.
And, most of those guys in that generation, most voice actors are very nice people.
Mm-hmm.
There's very few that I don't like. But the guys of that generation were really special because they were real pros. Nowadays, you can be a cartoon voice actor if you have four voices.
Mm-hmm.
Dawes, June, Mel, Paul, Don. Mm-hmm. Those guys had hundreds and hundreds of voices, and they'd invent new ones every time.
Yeah.
They were very versatile. It was a different kind of actor that we have today.
Mm-hmm. What's the most bizarre thing that ever happened to you at a magic show?
The most bizarre thing that ever happened to me, it wasn't a magic show, it was a Vegas show, but it had a magician in it.
Same thing.
There was a hotel called, at the time it was called the Paddle Wheel Hotel. It went through four or five other incarnations. It's now, I think, called the Greek Isles.
Okay.
But this time, they were trying to get a very adult show in Vegas to try to have... They were trying to have the most adult show they could get away with having.
Okay.
And they had a show called Hot Lips, I think it was called, or no. Mm-hmm. Hot Tricks. No. I don't remember the name exactly. It had hot in it.
Okay.
And the star of the show was a comedian named Pete Barbeauty.
Okay.
And he had in the show, it was Pete Barbeauty, funny, one of the funniest men I've ever met in my life, a four-piece jazz band that played for him, six of the best-looking women who took their clothes off, you could imagine, and a magician by the name of Valentino, who later became famous as the masked magician on Fox.
I know who he is.
Mm-hmm. All right? Mm-hmm. So I knew Pete Barbeauty. I went to see him. I'm backstage sitting on a milk crate in his dressing room. And there was one dressing room. And in the dressing room dressed the four-piece jazz guys, the magician, and then in the next dressing room were the showgirls dressing. And then there was one other dressing room there where the male MALE Express dressed, which was a Chippendales show that housed used the same room. And I'm sitting there for hours on end, learning Pete Barbeauty with the big cigar, telling me stories about Buddy Hackett and Frank Sinatra and Jackie Green and the Rat Pack and playing Vegas in the 60s and all these things. And as I'm sitting there, there are nude male bodybuilders walking past me and nude female showgirls. And there's the four-piece jazz band. And to my left, Valentino is stuffing doves on his person. He has a dove and duck show. In the course of his show, he makes a bunch of doves appear, and he makes two live ducks appear.
Okay.
All right? And I'm sitting on this little milk crate with my elbows in because I can't put them out, because if I put them out to the right, I'm going to bump into a naked person. Uh-huh. If I put them out to the left, I'm going to bump into Valentino with his ducks and his... he's 3 inches from me, and he's trying real hard to bind the feet of his doves with threads and secrete them on his person without letting me see it.
Oh.
Because he wants to keep his secrets. This is the same guy who went on TV and showed everybody how you cut the woman in half.
But he's okay. Insert want right. noise here from the music right. trumpet.
And I said, look, I'm a member of the Magic Castle. See, here's my card. See, I know how this stuff is done. It's okay.
Yeah.
He goes, oh, I don't like having people see my preparation. All right. So I'm sitting there trying to focus on these wonderful anecdotes that Pete is telling me when there's nude people walking around me and doves and ducks and fish. And wow. And I have this kind of hearing. It's a little tricky thing. I hear every conversation at the same volume. If I'm in a restaurant, the people two tables away from me are talking, and I'm talking to you at my table, I will hear them as well as I hear you. So I'm focusing. It's like sensory overload. I'm hearing everything at once.
Your whole life
And I look up in the mirror, and there's these huge breasts, naked breasts going past me. All right. So finally, Pete's going out on stage. Now, it's a rainy, crummy Sunday night, and the audience is like half empty. And I go to the wings to watch, this is the early show, I go to the wings to watch Pete from the wings. And he goes out and he tells his best joke, and nobody laughs. And he tells his next best joke, and nobody laughs. And he walks over, he finally turns to the audience, the 11 people who are in the house, and he says, excuse me one moment, ladies and gentlemen. And he walks to the wings and he whispers to me, I tell security to throw them out, but I have a feeling security threw them in here. And he goes back out and tells another joke, and nobody laughs. But the band laughs, because the band loves the fact that Pete's in trouble.
Yeah.
And he finally won them over. He finally just kept working them, and he got the audience laughing. I don't know how he did it, you know, but he got the audience laughing.
Okay.
So then we go back in, and the dancers go out and take their clothes off. And this is the girls now. The girls are on his show. The Male Express is in another show.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Anyway, so this for the second show, We stay backstage. I didn't even go to the wings for this. And Pete's telling me more stories. And the Mail Express has left. They've done their show. These guys have all cleared out. Mm-hmm. They've gone home. So the other dressing room is now open. So the girls are running back and forth. The showgirls are running back and forth using the shower in the male dressing room and using the shower in the female dressing room because they're getting very sweaty and they like literally come off stage, shower, put their next outfit on.
Oh, wow.
And they come on stage, strip off their outfit, and take a quick shower, and put the next thing on. So this is one dancer that Pete has introduced me to, and I should preface by saying this is many years before I met my friend Carolyn.
Okay.
So Pete has decided to fix me up with one girl dancer in the show. What a fine guy Pete was. And she is talking to me about agents, and I'm going to help her with her Hollywood career, and we're going to go out afterwards and we're going to talk about, I'm going to tell her about agents and headshots and things
right,
like that.
Right, because after seeing her naked for hours, that's exactly
that's
what
right.
she wanted
yes,
to do.
Yes, yes.
Talk to
and
her
I,
about
okay.
her future career.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
So she comes off stage and asks me a question, then she runs back on stage to do the next number.
Uh-huh.
Valentino finishes his act and he produces these two live ducks.
Okay.
He comes back in. He's now finished with his set for the evening. The show is still going on, however, because Pete's about to go out. And Valentino puts the two ducks in the shower in the male dressing room and turns on the water. Okay. So, and he goes off to secure his props for the night.
Mm-hmm.
The showgirl friend of mine, my new friend showgirl, comes off stage, strips off her outfit that she was, what little she was wearing, and she's going to go grab a shower, and she gets there, and there's ducks in the shower. And she turns around, she yells at Valentino, get your damn ducks out of the shower. She used a different word than damn.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the shower. And Valentino comes in and says, oh, my ducks have been looking forward to their shower all day. Please let them have their shower. They'd love the water. So she gets in the shower with the ducks.
Okay.
Now, for the entire time I've been there, I have been doing a very fine job of pretending that I'm used to talking to naked showgirls. I'm so used to being around fabulous looking naked women that it's just, oh yes, normal. Mm-hmm. And I look them right in the eye and like that. And I'm now standing right outside the shower and she is showering with a squeeze bottle of liquid soap with ducks. And I think to myself, I can no longer pretend this is normal. So, and then suddenly Valentino pops his head and he says, oh, don't use the soap, it'll make my ducks sick. So the showgirl is like, she's showering and she's saying to me, now, do you think I should get an agent from here or should I wait till I get to Hollywood to get one? And I'm saying, I'm just completely, I can no longer pretend that I'm used to any of this. Okay? And then when he says don't use the soap, she opens the door and kicks the ducks out of the shower and closes the door. So there's wet ducks walking around.
Wow.
And for some inexplicable reason, okay, and the wet ducks don't know where to go, so they decide to go back out on stage.
Oh, no.
And I suddenly go, oh, I've got to stop them. Now, I later realized that Pete Barghouti would have probably loved it if the ducks had gone out on stage because he could have ad-libbed about it and it would have made the show more interesting. He would have handled it. He's an old pro. But I suddenly thought, oh, my life depends on stopping the ducks. So I run over and I start shooing the wet ducks away from them. They're going, oh, no, don't go out on stage. No, go back. I'm talking to them like they're going to understand
me. Of course, of course.
Okay? And the showgirl gets out of the shower, so it's going, and she comes over and she starts helping me moose them. And I think to myself, wait a minute. I'm backstage at a Las Vegas hotel and a naked showgirl and I are herding wet ducks.
Why is this not on stage?
You know, it was much more entertaining than the show would have been anyway.
Jeez.
And finally we get the ducks back in there and we pen them back in like that. And this dog is looking at me like he doesn't believe it for a second.
No, I think he's saying it in a different
detail. All right, anyway.
Muggsy has put his head on Mark's shoulder and is just gazing up
yes.
at his face incredulously.
So, because every so often it's helpful to summarize what's happened to you in a sentence. And that was my sentence. I'm backstage here herding wet ducks.
Yes,
and we finally get the ducks back in. The showgirl gets dressed. And Pete comes off stage, and I say, he finishes his set, and it's fine. We say goodbye, and the showgirl and I go out to get a bite to eat like that, and talk further about her career, and I am just completely out of it. I'm hearing ducks quacking.
I know.
We're sitting in the coffee shop at the hotel. We went across the street to the to Circus, and we're sitting in the Circus coffee shop, and I've lost all sensory perception here. I can't say anything more about the. I'm hearing ducks everywhere I go. This is basically the end of the story here. Going up here, here. But that was the strangest moment of my life. And at the end of the evening, I walked her back to her car, and she says to me, "Did you have an interesting evening, Mark?" And I go, "Yeah." And this is why I love show business.
Oh my god. I could just see the shower door open and a bunch of ducks fly out with a pissed off naked showgirl. Don't get out. I need to use a soap.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so every time I would see Valentino doing the masked magician thing.
Yes.
And I would think of this That's my weirdest magician related story ever.
It's fabulous.
And he wouldn't let me see how he was hiding the doves on his body, but he will let everybody in America see how they saw the lady in half.
There you go. You know, and I thought I had a story when I was in Philadelphia with Jonathan and Charlotte, and I was singing "Wishing You Were Somehow Here Again" to a man dressed as a phantom who was still there while a union guy is bent over showing his crack to the entire audience while he moves my prop 5 minutes later.
That's entertaining, too.
Not as entertaining as ducks in the shower, dude. Totally won.
No, ducks in the shower.
You totally
ducks in the
shower. Won.
Great story.
Can I get some ducks? I want to shower with ducks every day. No. I won't use soap.
No.
No.
That's bad.
No ducks.
It's bad. I won't use soap.
Yeah.
I know. No. I can't get ducks.
No ducks.
I guess. No ducks. No ducks. No ducks. Oh, my gosh. How awesome. Well, Mark, I think we successfully kept up the illusion that these were recorded on 3 separate weeks and 3 different days.
Yes. That's true. We did. Finally.
We sure fooled them.
and we're not done.
No.
There is so much more I want to ask you. And I didn't make a list again. And every time I'm like, oh, I get so excited that Mark is coming. I get so excited that he's coming. I never make a list of questions. We should do a questions night with Mark.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Where the fans write in and ask you questions.
Mm-hmm.
Would you do that?
They're going to be, what do you do?
No.
Who are you?
They're not.
Why are you on this show so often?
When is Tower Prep coming back?
Oh, exactly. You stop.
Do you really know Paul Dini? What's he like?
Oh, you know, I got that question the other day. I said, no, I don't. I don't know a thing about him. I don't know who he is. And they were like, really? I said, yeah, really. And they were like, oh, you have the same last name. I said, yeah.
Yeah.
That was it.
There is no Paul Dini. He's just an amalgam of different...
it's a magic character.
Yeah.
Hysterious.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you that my cousin David, the author, his wife is named Dini?
No.
There's a Dini Evanier in this world.
Wow.
Is that her first name?
It's her first name, is Dini.
Wow.
That is cool.
Wow, that's pretty awesome.
A Dini Evanier.
Yeah.
I like that sound.
Yeah.
I like Evanier Dini, too. It's good.
Evanier Dini sounds like a really bad Jewish magician.
Yeah.
You know what? It does. And that is an act I would like to see at Princess Magic's Cavalcade of Back Alley Vaudeville.
Nice.
And that just keeps adding, I keep adding words to the title every time I report it to somebody. Speaking of adding words, we're going to have Mark Evanier back.
Yes.
We're going to have Twitter questions, and I'm going to have my list, because I have so many things that I want to ask you. I see you far too infrequently, and you're really freaking fascinating, dude.
It's all an illusion. It's all a trick.
He's not even here.
Yeah, he never even came.
Paul mastered his ventriloquism.
Yes. Well, all right, I'm going to sign off. I'm Misty Lee.
I am Sergio Aragonés.
That wasn't even close.
You are not Sergio Aragonés.
I know Sergio Aragonés, and you, my friend, are not Sergio.
That's right. I am Sergio Aragonés.
That's closer.
I'm Mark Evanier, the perpetual guest on this show.
And we are lucky to have you. All right.
And I'm going to bed.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or @Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.